Welcome to today's episode of the Normalized Surrogacy podcast by Surrogacy Mentor. I'm your host, Carrie Flamer Powell, experienced gestational surrogate, surrogacy agency founder, and owner of Surrogacy Mentor and Modern Parent Mentor, where our aim is a safe, ethical, and enjoyable surrogacy journey for all. Today, I am joined by our very special guest, educator and author, Rachel Ginocchio. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you and chat with you. So today we are talking about sex education and the need for assisted reproduction, including insemination, IVF, donor conception, and surrogacy, to all be included in classroom instruction when we're talking about sex education. This is 2024, and things have changed since sex education in schools became a thing. So before we dig into all of that, let me share a little bit of information about Rachel. So Rachel holds a master's degree in public health, which is the MPH, with a focus in maternal and child health. She received her degree at the University of Washington as an MCHB Economics Fellow, and her master's thesis is published in a peer-reviewed academic journal. Rachel directed two women's reproductive health clinics and served as a health communications specialist for the American Sexual Health Association. As a genetics community planner, she co-developed and widely presented a five-year strategic plan for genetics in Oregon. She now teaches puberty and human reproduction in private and public schools in Portland. Rachel spent 8 years building her family through assisted reproduction and adoption. She emerged from parenthood writing, teaching, and presenting a modernized version of human reproduction. She is thrilled to be debuting her first book, Roads to Family, All the Ways We Come to Be. So Rachel, I'm again so excited to chat with you today, and I will just right off the bat just take the rabbit out of the hat, as it were, and just make everyone aware that I am one of the people that you originally interviewed for your book, and my gestational surrogacy story is in your book. So I'm super excited to talk about the book and the awesome work that you're doing. So tell me a little bit, let's start off with you telling me a little bit about your personal journey through assisted reproduction, because I would say seriously, maybe 80% of the people working in assisted reproduction as professionals come to this because of their personal experience. So what is your experience?
Yes. Oh, well, thank you for that lovely introduction, Carrie. And it has been a pleasure working with you and getting to know you. And it is an honor to have your family story as part of the book as well. My and my husband's journey started back in 2000. So my kids are now 21 and 16. So it was quite a while ago. But I was just finishing graduate school, and my husband and I thought it would be perfect to have our family start our family the summer after I graduated. Of course, Carrie, little did we know that everything we had ever knew and understood about how easy it was to get pregnant was, you know, going to go flying out the door.
Right.
So, like most people, we tried for many, many months, of course, to no avail. And then I started charting everything there was to chart. And yeah, again, not happening.
Right.
So we eventually got ourselves to a fertility clinic. And at the time, I think the requisite number of IUIs was 6. I don't know if that still holds, but we did 6 rounds of IUIs. Wow. Nothing worked. Mm-hmm. And so finally, we turned our attention to in vitro fertilization. Awesome. And after 2 rounds of IVF, we gave birth to our son, and he is now the 21-year-old that I mentioned at the beginning. When he was about 2, we started doing IVF again. We figured that since it had worked the first time, it would work again.
Sure.
But it didn't work. And at the time, I could have told you exactly every single detail of every single round, and now it's all a bit fuzzy. All I remember is that there were many fresh rounds, a frozen round, and a failed round with donor eggs. So it felt like we're just hitting our heads against the wall. And so we finally turned our attention to adoption. And adoption had had been there with us all along, mm-hmm. but I was the one that had been hesitant because my dad grew up in foster care and my sister's adopted. And I had all of these preconceived notions about how my dad and my sisters, how their origins impacted them.
Right.
My dad died in 2001, so I couldn't exactly have a conversation with him, but I remember picking up the phone and just having these intense, heartfelt discussions with my sister, discussions mm-hmm. that I had never had with her before. Sure. She was just super open and honest with me, and she was the one that really helped me get over my worries and fears about mm-hmm. adoption.
Okay.
We pursued infant adoption and the whole family went to Vietnam in 2008. We adopted our daughter, who is now 16. Mm. And so that was kind of our 8-year journey to grow our family.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. So, and you did it at a time where, I mean, adoption, I guess, was still pretty commonplace, but IVF was still emerging as something that, you know, people definitely didn't talk about as much as they talk about it now, for sure. And the technology was completely different back then. Definitely. Yeah.
And it was lonely. Like there was the internet, yes, but there was no Facebook groups or other ways to connect with other people. I had a support group through the fertility clinic, mm-hmm. but we talked about it within that group and talking about infertility in the outside world, as we would mm-hmm. say. To other friends and family was a whole different ballgame than the lots of resources and support that people can find these days.
Yeah, completely different. I mean, I think about just 10 years ago when I started in this industry, how things were so different. So I can't imagine 20 plus years ago. So you have a lot of experience personally and professionally over these last years. So let's dig a little bit into that. So I want to preface a little bit before I ask these questions with kind of what you're doing now. So the book that you have is, again, Roads to Family, All the Ways We Come to Be. And I know that I kind of was going to bring this up at the later part of our discussion, but I think it's good to start with it. So tell me about what came first, the idea to go into the school system and educate a particular age group about modern assisted reproduction and fertility and sex education, or the book, which came first? Because you're doing the book and you're doing a lot of actual education, right?
Yes.
So which came first, and what demographic is this aimed at? Is this little tiny kids? Is this college kid? Like what is this aimed for?
Yeah, sure. It was so funny when you were saying, like, what came first? I'm like, the chicken or the egg, the sperm or the egg. No, that's just my sex educator brain.
Right.
The connections. So the idea for the book came first, to tell you the truth, because it originated when I was trying to explain human reproduction to my son. Mm-hmm. He had always known he was conceived via IVF. We have this great picture of the three embryos in the petri dish. And we'd like to ask him, you know, which one do you think was you?
Right.
The connection to one of those photos, one of the embryos in the photos. But really, I was trying to explain how he came to be in the world. And mm-hmm. we sat down, I had all the industry best books, and I started to read to him, and I was fumbling over the words.
Right.
And of course, it's not because I'm uncomfortable with this language, right? I've been in reproductive and sexual health education for many years prior mm-hmm. To having him, but it was because none of the books explained how he came to be in the world in a way that wasn't othering or marginalizing, you know? And those were the ones that even mentioned assisted reproduction. Most of them didn't even mention reproduction. So I decided that I should write a book, not only to explain his origins, but I was thinking about, what about all the families with single parents mm-hmm. and same-sex partners mm-hmm. and all the other ways that we have of being family?
Right.
They're not explained in a book that starts out with mommy and daddy love each other very much.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So the book actually came first. Trying to get a book published is not usually an easy task unless you are a very famous person.
Right.
So the publishing process is pretty long. And so while I was sort of chugging through the process, I realized that these concepts or this idea that we've got to stop explaining reproduction the way we've always been explaining it, that we've got to expand our explanation, you know, like you said, to include IVF, insemination, donor conception, and surrogacy, that the concept was the most important thing, not the book. And so that's when I started to revitalize my sex education profession, getting into the schools, having workshops in the neighborhood, and figuring out all sorts of different ways to sort of serve that mission of changing the way we explain human reproduction and family formation.
I love that. And so is it middle school then, as I understand it? What's the age range?
Yeah, the age range is middle and high school, families and classrooms. So think, you know, families with littler kids could pick and choose pieces of the book. There's some fun illustrations they can look at and have conversations. But the target for this book is middle and high school, families and classrooms.
Got it. Yes. And I've read the book, of course. And it's really packed full of lots of great information, but it's in a way that that demographic can definitely relate to and understand it, which is great. So I love that about it. So I know that you are based in Portland, Oregon, where I lived for 12 years. I had my daughter there in Portland and started my surrogacy business in Portland. And I know Portland to be extremely liberal, if we're talking politically or socially, very liberal, very open to alternative ways of family building and sexuality and diversity. That's not necessarily the case in other parts of even Oregon, but outside of Oregon and other states. So have you expanded any of your like speaking engagements or teaching to states that have been less receptive to this idea of alternative families and assisted reproduction?
Yeah, I know. You're so right. You nailed Portland on the head. We have this little bubble here, and it sometimes can be extreme in the other direction, but I'm sure that is a conversation for another time. But I haven't, Carrie, and I welcome the opportunity. I don't shy from controversy. I don't shy from conflict. So if there is any listeners out there who, want help or assistance or want to kind of push the boundaries of what's going on in their states, please, they can reach out to me. What I found in Portland, even though we are so super progressive, when and we can talk more about what we're doing in terms of sex education, but I have to say, when it came to pushing the idea that we needed to expand the explanation of reproduction and family formation, Portland was really slow on the uptake. It took me quite a few years to get anyone in the field to really listen. So one thing was that it always seemed like there was a more pressing issue at hand, like preventing unintended pregnancy, which has always been at the forefront of sex education. So, but when I started talking about IVF, donor conception, and surrogacy, it got poo-pooed as a, quote, rich white man sport. And I kid you not, Carrie, this is the words used by a fellow sex educator. So yeah, it dawned on me that in order to move the needle at all, I was going to have to unpack this issue. And so there were a bunch of issues wrapped up in that. But one of them was I had to explain that Black women are almost twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience infertility. They're just less likely to access care for many reasons. So that got progressive Portland to listen up a little bit. And then I also had to explain the nuances of cost. Cost was the other issue that was sort of wrapped up in that, that statement that the sex educator had used. So I had to explain all the nuances of cost, that not all of these methodologies cost a fortune. There are huge nuances. And that also the things that people had to do to pay for their family building services, like things they had to do for services they can't really afford, but they do anyway.
Right.
And, you know, so the bottom line I had to keep pushing was that, yes, it stinks that not everyone can afford the services that they need. Mm-hmm. And we should, of course, fight for equitable access to care. Absolutely.
Right.
But just because parents had to shell out a lot of money to develop their family mm-hmm. doesn't give us a right to leave kids' origin stories mm-hmm. out of the explanation of reproduction. We don't get to marginalize and other kids mm-hmm. and families mm-hmm. because of whether they had access or didn't have access to care. Right. So I had to really break down the equity issue for mm-hmm. progressive Portlanders mm-hmm. and talk about why equity is important. Of course, we want to fight for equitable access, but mm-hmm. that is a separate issue than why it's important to expand our explanation of reproduction.
Right. Absolutely. I think that's huge for several reasons, because I'm thinking about my daughter who's in your demographic. She's 12 years old. She is donor conceived with a sperm donor. And if she's sitting in a classroom for a sex education course, and all they're talking about is how a woman gets pregnant after having sex with her male partner, that's not going to resonate with her at all. That's not how she came to be. And it's also not going to resonate with trans kids, lesbian or gay kids who are thinking, well, wait, if that's the way you have a baby, how am I going to have a family? Am I not allowed to have a family? Is it not okay for me to have a family? And you hear people who are my age, which I'm 47. If you hear people who are my age saying that are gay, saying, I never thought I could have a family. That was never discussed, right? That was never talked about that I could have a family because I'm gay. And so if I was gay, I was left out of the conversation. So I think in 2024, what you're doing is so important because these kids need to know that building a family looks very different now than it did 10, 20, 30 years ago. And there are options that encompass everyone and their choice of who they are and how they want to build their family.
Yes. Beautifully said. Exactly. Yeah. And that is exactly the work that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. And I moved a couple of years ago from Oregon back to Arizona, and what you're doing could definitely be used in the schools here. So I may be chatting with you after about that, because it's definitely needed in places outside of Portland. So let's talk about the book itself. So tell me about sort of what is in the book that you think specifically to surrogacy that you feel is important for this demographic of middle schoolers to understand. I know that you have several stories in here. Again, one of them is mine. Excuse me. For those that want to read it, it's page 79 and 80. That's my story. And can I tell you a funny story really quick about this?
Yep.
So I chose fake names to protect the identity of my intended parents, as well as the little boy that I delivered. But do you want to know like why I chose some of these names? Because it's kind of funny.
Yes, I do. Why? Yes, I do, Carrie.
So I named Nancy. I named my intended parents, who were a lesbian couple in real life, Nancy and Hillary. So that's Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. And then I named myself Emily, and my wife, who's my ex-wife now, but my wife at the time, Elaine. So Emily is one of the Indigo Girls, which is my favorite band ever. And Elaine happens to be my mom's middle name. So anyway, I chose some names just for funny, stupid reasons. But so there's my story in there, but there's also a couple of other stories about surrogacy and the different ways that people come to surrogacy. So first of all, how did you find this? And what do you think is important for your demographic to get from those stories?
So the most important thing that I hope kids take away from the book is that there are so many different ways that we bring children into the world and so many different ways that they become part of our family. And so when we expand the explanation to include insemination, in vitro fertilization, donor conception, and surrogacy, we just open the doorway to thinking about things like infertility and miscarriages. But it also enables us to think about and talk about single parenthood and family building for those that identify as LGBTQIA. So, you know, part of the idea is that sex only works to create a pregnancy for able-bodied, fertile, straight adults.
Right.
Everybody else needs another way.
Right.
So that's why we want to talk about all of the other ways.
Yes.
So the book, each chapter focuses on a different family, and I worked really hard to ensure that there were diverse family structures that represented a wide swath of demographics.
Right.
And then I weave the science of reproduction into each of the families. And so, and then the other thing I try to do is start with the first family, start with some basic concepts, and for each subsequent family to be able to introduce a different concept within assisted reproduction. So hopefully the family story scaffold in terms of the information that's being added with each family.
Yeah. And I think that's so important for this demographic of middle school, high school, to weave it with lots of stories to like illuminate the points and the science, because these are real stories, right? These are real people. And having that story behind it, that's how this generation lives, is through storytelling and social media and information sharing. And so that's what lights up their brain is, okay, you can teach me the science all day, but if you tell me how it worked within this couple or this family or this single parent, that makes sense to me, because I watch people's social lives all day long on social media.
Yes, you're right. You are so right about that.
Yeah.
And the surrogacy piece, I loved the surrogacy piece. I think one of the greatest misconceptions, not only among students, but amongst adults, is people don't understand the difference between a traditional or genetic surrogate and a gestational carrier. So it was really important to me that I had both types of surrogacy journeys in the book. So again, students could learn and see that there are similarities. Of course, surrogates are pregnant with and give birth to a baby for another family, but that there are differences amongst that, and different surrogacy arrangements are going to work for different families. That as long as the families are abiding by ethical standards, that they have the legal representation they need, that they have done their due diligence in terms of really understanding what's involved in the journey, and that everyone has the support they need to make that a successful journey, that there are many ways that can be successful.
I love that. Yes. Well, I think it's important for people to read the book. First of all, I think it's important for them to share it with their kids that are in this demographic age, to talk about it with their schools if it's not something that's already part of their sex education program. And I kind of want to get your take also on, you know, what role do you feel like parents / caregivers should play versus schools in education? Because I know that that's part of the more conservative school system's viewpoints, which is that sort of thing should be taught at home, and we shouldn't be involved in teaching people, you know, about children, about sex or sex education or family formation. What do you think about that that thought process?
Yes. Can we go out for a beer and talk about all of this one day?
Right.
Okay. So I do actually think, Carrie, that parents, guardians, caregivers should be the number one go-to for their youth when it comes to sex education. They're the ones that can answer their kids' questions as they come up, you know, which is a very organic way of answering these questions. Parents and caregivers can also listen for, look out for those teachable moments, which I think are equally as valuable as answering questions, especially when kids don't necessarily want to ask a whole lot of questions. Those teachable moments provide opportunities where adults at home can insert some information, insert some values and whatnot. And I think the values piece is huge when it comes to sex education. So sex education at school is really important because it kind of gives us a common baseline of understanding. But teachers shouldn't be inserting their own values. Whereas families, on the other hand, you can share with your kids your hopes, your expectations. I'm sure there are family rules as well. But the idea is to help kids develop their own sense of values when it comes to romantic and sexual relationship. When parents and caregivers don't take on this role, Carrie, and the school isn't tackling it in a way that's particularly helpful, the kids are going to learn about this stuff from elsewhere. They're going to learn about it from their friends. They're going to go on the internet and learn it from social media.
Right.
And we also have to acknowledge that kids are absorbing all of this information from things like advertisements and video games and music.
Right.
So that's why I really feel like adults and caregivers, parents need to be their kids' number one go-to when it comes to sexual health. Sure. And it's funny because a bunch of research says, you know, kids will protest. They'll say, ew, don't want to talk about it. But really? I think we have seen that kids really do want their parents to talk about it. They don't want their parents to say, do this, don't do this. Like, they don't want the hard and fast rules. But we've seen research that says that teens really do want to have real conversations with their parents and their adult caregivers. So I think home and school can play a role, but like you said, sex education is becoming more and more controversial. It's becoming harder and harder to agree on content and implementation. So I think home is really going to have to step up their game if they want their kids to have accurate information. And I do.
I agree. Absolutely, I agree. My daughter will be reading your book for sure, because I think it's important and I want it to fill in the gaps of what she might be missing out here in Arizona. Even though she goes to a very liberal, progressive charter school, I still think that she's probably getting less of a well-rounded sexual education, sex ed education, than she would in Portland or somewhere like that. What do you wish that youth educators and caregivers and parents knew about sex education in 2024?
Yeah, sure. So, gosh, that's a hard one. So I think when people think of sex education, they literally get caught up in the word sex.
Yeah.
But sex education, very little of it actually has to do with sex.
Yeah.
Sex education is really about giving youth the knowledge and more specifically the skills they need to develop healthy relationships. It's all about the relationships. So we want them to have healthy relationships with themselves, with other people, and the world around them. And so when people get really caught up about sex ed, what it is, all the body parts and how they're working, I'm like, it's not about body parts and how they work. It's about healthy relationships. And when we talk about healthy relationships, my gosh, we are talking about something wonderful that human beings are able to have. So if the idea of sex ed is scary or even mortifying to adults, I try to encourage them to kind of flip the notion on its head. I want them to remind themselves that they want their kids to one day have loving adult romantic relationships. Like that's something that many adults wish for their children to have healthy, loving adult romantic relationships. So sex ed is just a way of getting them from where they are now to where they need to go as adults, doing it in a really positive way.
Right. I love that. And I would add to that, it's also bringing them up to speed with where we are with technology and fertility medicine and ways to build families. And it's also helping to keep them safe, right? To help them understand what they should be cautious about with, you know, as that my generation, sex education was all about prevention and, you know, being very careful about all these different things. I think there's still an element of that, of course, that's super important. But also bringing into them the whole picture of, like, you know, in your friend group today of that age group, you probably have at least one friend who was not born from a man and a woman having sex. At least one of your friends probably did not come into their family in that exact way. And I don't know that the same would be said maybe 10, 20 years ago, right? So I think it's broadening the horizons.
Even in Oregon, we now have what we call comprehensive sexuality education. Mm-hmm. So the idea isn't just to focus on anatomy and physiology, like how our body parts work to create a pregnancy and spread infection. Now we talk about a whole gamut of topics. So we talk about boundaries and consent, sexual orientation, gender norms and expectations. So we've thrown into the idea of sex education all these other topics. Mm-hmm. Carrie, when it still comes to that reproduction topic, we are still repeating the same story. Sex makes a baby. Babies are the result of sex. And so again, like I said, it has taken years. And finally, in this year's sex ed standard or health standards in Oregon, finally, insemination, IVF, donor conception, and surrogacy to be taught at fifth grade.
Love it.
But mostly when we're talking about that reproductive piece, even in states that have comprehensive sexuality education, that reproductive topic is still not being expanded. Right. And that's really where my work lies, is in really making sure that we are acknowledging how every single human being comes into the world and how they become part of their family.
I love it. Well, I've just really enjoyed chatting with you and loved being part of this book. Again, the name of the book, Roads to Family, All the Ways We Come to Be, is out now, where I'm sure you can get it online, any place where books are sold. So I think it's well worth the read for everyone listening, as well as especially if you have kids in this demographic of middle and high school, to read it, because it has lots of great stories, which are all based on true stories. And it also has really good science and information in there that I think everyone in 2024 needs to be aware of and educating their kids about. So thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Carrie, for having me. And thank you for all of the work that you do to support surrogates and families.
Thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of this episode of the Normalized Surrogacy Podcast. Again, I want to thank Rachel Ginocchio for joining me today. Be sure to check us out online at surrogacymentor.com. If you're interested in knowing whether surrogacy is right for you, take our easy 2-minute quiz on our website. Also, check us out online at modernparentmentor.com if you're considering an independent surrogacy journey as a surrogate or parent. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast to learn more about gestational surrogacy and how to have a safe, ethical, and enjoyable surrogacy journey. Talk to you next time.